This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by realizing your parents were actually right about a lot of stuff. Yeah, they really were. Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is called Who Was Aesop? Gratitude is the sign of noble souls. Quality, not quantity. Appearances are misleading. One good turn deserves another. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Honesty is the best policy. Look before you leap. Birds of a feather flock together. Misery loves company. Persuasion is better than force. All of these phrases are thousands of years old, and they were all written by a guy from ancient Greece named Aesop. Or were they? It might be more accurate to say we have them because of a 2,500-year-old chain of storytellers who think they were written by Aesop. But who was this guy anyway? Is it possible to know? I wanted to delve into this question because I have a lot of upcoming episodes planned about Aesop's fables and the many translations and adaptations that stem from them. His fables are embedded in the foundation of literature and have influenced storytellers worldwide in a way almost no other sources have. Understanding the origins of these fables will help us a lot when we discuss individual tales later on. There's no historical evidence that says, yeah, a dude named Aesop definitely lived at No. 6 Genius Street in Delphi, right by the pita bread bakery, and here's an autographed first edition of his complete works. For perspective, there's quite a lot we don't even know about William Shakespeare, and he only lived 400 years ago. Aesop is a figure so far back in history that we can't be sure if he really existed, or if he personally wrote all of the fables attributed to him. Different ancient Greek writers disagreed about where he was born. Aristotle said he was from Thrace, but others said he was from the city of Sardis or the island of Samos. Pretty much all the early sources we have say that he was born about 620 BCE, and that he was a slave who was eventually freed by his master, who recognized his intellectual talent. Aesop traveled extensively and managed to become a person of great renown, getting involved in civic life. Physical descriptions of him vary quite a lot. Some accounts say he was hideously ugly. Others say he was tall and dark-skinned, coming from somewhere in sub-Saharan Africa. He landed a gig working for Croesus, the king of Lydia, working out of the king's lavish palace in the capital city of Sardis. Croesus is a person that we can pin down historically. He was the first king in the world to issue gold coins with a standardized level of purity. Other rulers had issued coins before, but the real value of the currency could vary wildly because they were made of electrum, a naturally occurring blend of gold, silver, and other metals. However, the percentages of gold and silver in electrum coins couldn't be known, so it was hard to pin down the value of money beyond the personal power of a king. Scientists working for Croesus developed the first reliable technique for separating pure gold from silver, making it possible to have coins with a definite value. Croesus was known for his well-stocked treasury, and the expression, "rich as Croesus," has been used since antiquity to refer to a wealthy person. Aesop is said to have worked in various positions for Croesus, working his way up to become a senior minister of state. He visited many cities in ancient Greece as an ambassador, often being trusted to resolve major disputes. He's credited with going to both Athens and Corinth to work out differences between the citizens of those cities and their leaders. To help persuade both ordinary people and their rulers to behave better, he would tell his famous fables, which focus on moral behavior and making wise choices. His last mission didn't go very well, though. He was sent to the city of Delphi to distribute quite a large amount of gold to the citizens as a gift from Croesus. Delphi was regarded as the literal center of the world. It has the location of the navel of Gaia, the goddess of the earth. Yes, the earth goddess has a belly button, and it's in Delphi. You can still go see it. It's a pretty little carved rock. This was the site of the Pythian Games, one of the forerunners of the later Olympic Games. These games were dedicated to Apollo, one of the most important cities to ancient Greeks. The temple to Apollo in Delphi was the home of the Pythia, the high priestess of the temple, who served as the most famous oracle in the Greek world. Kings and their ministers would make quite long journeys to consult her and use what she said to guide important personal and political decisions. All of this had the effect of making the citizens of Delphi a bit full of themselves, apparently. Aesop was sent there to give him a bunch of money, but when he arrived, he was so disgusted by their pride and greediness that he sent the cash right back to his boss. The Delphians executed him, which proved that Aesop was right about them being awful people, although he wouldn't have been able to gloat about it. Aesop's murder brought down divine punishment on the city, and calamities followed one after the other until they made reparations and performed public penance. That's one version of the story, anyway. Another tale says he went to Delphi, stole a gold cup, and was tossed off a cliff as punishment. Some sources don't say why he was killed at all. Phaedrus, the Athenian aristocrat famous for interviewing Socrates in the writings of Plato, wrote that a statue was carved by the famous sculptor Lysippus and erected in Athens in Aesop's memory. If this is true, it would mean that the Athenians didn't think the author died in shame, but rather that they wanted to show respect for Aesop and contempt for Delphi. The statue would also conveniently protect them from the sorts of punishments the gods had rained down on Delphi for disrespecting Aesop, who clearly had divine favor. Over 700 fables have been attributed to Aesop. The ancient Greeks clearly believed he was a real person who wrote the fables, which were held in high regard. When Socrates was in prison, he spent his time turning the fables into poems. The historian Herodotus and the playwright Aristophanes both referred to Aesop as the author of his fables. Herodotus was born only 80 years after Aesop's death, so it's not unreasonable to think that a somewhat reliable verbal or written history of Aesop could have survived that long. Herodotus traveled a lot and visited many of the same cities that Aesop would have gone to. He could have met the grandchildren of people who had known Aesop personally. While there's no hard proof of his existence, the fact that Herodotus, the father of history, seems certain that Aesop was a real person makes me think that somebody named Aesop probably existed, and that he might have been famous for telling catchy stories with an easily understood but compelling moral message. I don't think Aesop wrote every single one of the stories attributed to him. Over the years, variations of his tales or stories with a similar structure would have been added to the list. We've seen this sort of thing happen in more recent history. American Tall Tales are a great way to watch how fact and fiction meld together, because we have enough documentation of recent history that it's easier to figure out which parts of the stories are true. Johnny Appleseed really did wander from Appalachia to Illinois to Canada, planting groves of apple trees, preaching conservation, spreading kindness to animals, showing altruism to human beings, and hoping for racial harmony. There were Native American tribes at that time that were understandably hostile to white interlopers in their territory, but even they left him alone because he was just a really nice guy. Calamity Jane really did wear men's buckskin suits, but she probably made up almost everything she said about being a battle-hardened trail scout in the Old West. Though she really did save a stagecoach full of passengers by taking over the reins when the driver was killed by an attacking group of Indians. She also gained respect in her adopted town of Deadwood, South Dakota, by nursing the victims of a smallpox outbreak in the 1870s. She died of complications resulting from her long-term alcoholism and became a legend from there. pretty much every depiction of her in film and television is all made up, but it's hard not to enjoy them when she's played by the likes of Jean Arthur, Jane Russell, and Doris Day. Casey Jones really did sacrifice his life by staying at his post as an engineer when he suddenly saw that the train he was driving, Ole 382, was about to collide with some parked trains that were not supposed to be on the tracks. He yelled to the engine's fireman to jump from the train, then stayed at his post and was able to reduce the speed of Ole 382 from 75 miles an hour down to 35. He was killed when his engine crashed into the caboose of the train ahead of them, but he saved the lives of every passenger on board, with only a few minor injuries reported. From there, Casey Jones became the stuff of legend, with countless stories, songs, and even cartoons made about him. Even the little train at Disneyland, the Casey Jr., is named for him. Then there's stories that are just a bunch of fun nonsense, like Paul Bunyan, who serves as a joking stereotype of loggers. Today, people write fan fiction of their favorite comic books. Back in the late 19th and early 20th century, loggers would make up Paul Bunyan stories for their own amusement, and the rest of society found the stories to be worth listening to. Similarly, Pecos Bill wasn't real, but I do love hearing about how he lassoed that tornado. The way that real people get made into legends is best summed up at the end of the film The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which opens and ends with a newspaper man pressing to get at the real truth of what happened during a gunfight that took place decades ago. After hearing the whole tale, he burns his notes, saying, "This is the West, sir. When legend becomes fact, print the legend." That sentiment resonates in many other cultures, and I suspect ancient Greece, which can be quite literally described as the Old West, was among them. In all likelihood, Aesop was a witty, capable bureaucrat who became famous for persuading people with stories that echoed the moral ideals that most people hold. Most of us don't like snobs and bullies, even if we sometimes act like snobs or bullies. We also dislike laziness and cruelty. We don't trust liars, and we despise thieves. Aesop's fables manage, with astonishingly few words, to cut through to basic ethical principles that govern pretty much every culture I can think of. The stories are simple enough that you don't have to be very old to understand them, and they make lots of use of animals, which kids also like. So it's unsurprising that until very recently, Aesop's fables were a very important part of children's education. They were quickly translated into Latin by the Romans. They stayed popular through the Middle Ages and were a smash hit during the Renaissance. The earliest English language version was printed in 1484 by William Caxton, the same printer who published Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales and Sir Thomas Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur, the best-known version of tales about King Arthur. Books were very difficult and expensive to publish in those early days, so the fact that Caxton chose the fables for printing shows how intellectually and commercially valuable they were. It's impossible to count the number of plays, paintings, novels, and poems written about Aesop and his fables, and they have remained a major influence on the world. As a child, Abraham Lincoln adored the version translated by G.F. Townsend. Aesop's fables have been an integral part of French culture, language, and education for hundreds of years, ever since Jean de La Fontaine adapted them in the 1600s. The symbolism, morality, and philosophy found in Aesop's fables have remained an integral part of world culture for more than 2,500 years. Their simplicity is their strength, and uncounted generations have used them as a foundation for future learning. The fables themselves will always remain more important than their author or authors, but learning a little bit more about Aesop himself introduces students to the field of historiography. Historiography is the study of how history is written down. It's important not to take every history book at face value. Some histories are unreliable because they're written by someone with an agenda or who didn't have all the facts available. It's important to teach children to consider the reliability of the information they read and to examine it for biases. Students can research Aesop and other semi-historical figures as a first foray into historiography. There are a lot of really interesting people who exist in a misty place between history and legend. Kids can find out about characters like Ragnar Lothbrok, Mulan, Pythagoras, King Arthur, the Queen of Sheba, Robin Hood, Homer, John Henry, Lycurgus, and Sun Tzu. These are just a few people who may or may not have existed. I've created a worksheet that you can give to students so they can begin exploring the idea of how history is written and who can and can't be confirmed as someone who really lived. Did Aesop really exist? Which version of his life is right? Are all of them wrong? What information about him has been lost or can never be known? These are really interesting questions, and I'd love to hear what you and your kids make of them. You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Please subscribe and give the show a rating. Send comments to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.